Right, we're now going to hear Bernie Sanders on the consequences of the bailout, and I don't think it'll be too much of a surprise that if you go around handing out free money and free credit to banks, then they're going to use this to get more money, either by making loans or by buying up others whose loans are failing. But following the commercial prerogative, we can't be that surprised. I like the title of his Too Big to Fail, Too Big to Exist bill. I'd like to apply that to government, not only financial institutions. Notice that he doesn't talk anywhere in this speech about climate change or global warming or decreasing water tables or, in fact, anything in the natural world, which, as an unwelcome guest listener, I dare say you've already highlighted, is one of the key weaknesses of this discourse. And the closest he gets, perhaps, is the idea that the American manufacturing industry is shutting down and manufacturing jobs are moving to China. But the focus on numbers and on money prevents him from looking at deeper issues which are going on. Will Americans be able to feed themselves and keep the lights on without huge subsidies of raw materials and food that they experience from the rest of the world through the financial system? I mean, jobs moving to China, it's a metaphor. What is a job? How does a job move to China? Does it get in a boat? Does it walk? I mean, it doesn't feel like a metaphor because these are everyday realities to us, and he must have lots of people from Vermont complaining about losing their job. And it feels like you need a job to exist because the current system conditions us to believe that. I'm starting to think that the more metaphors anybody uses when talking about the financial system, then the less I'm going to pay any attention to them, because if they have specialist knowledge, if they've been trained as an economist or an accountant, then they've been trained to see it almost always from a very narrow set of perspectives, if you like, the free market capitalists, because those with money have set up and taken over the training and the indoctrination institutes. Refer to Jeff Schmitt's Disciplined Minds on this. And if they haven't got specialist training, then they've picked it up in the main from television, from newspapers, from talking to people who've got it from similar places, and again, they are not in the business of giving an impartial overview of what's going on. They're presenting a very misleading set of facts, and whilst they might not be lying that much, they are certainly encouraging people to come to the wrong conclusion. And of course, if they're commercially run, then they're backed by big money, which has its own agenda. Metaphors are a great way, if you've got a lot of complex information, to get across the spirit of it to somebody who's already got an idea. They're a very poor way to explain in detail what's going on. So anybody talking about our economy has to get back on its feet so that it's tough enough to survive. I mean, what is our economy? Do we have an economy? The root of the word oikos means household. So are we, the American people, have a single household? And what is the feat of the economy? And talk about getting it going. Where is it going? These are very misleading phrases. And of course, whilst they seem to gel with our experience, they might make sense that money is power. It's got this embedded assumption within it that things in the future are going to work pretty much the way things worked in the past. And while that may be certainly true of natural systems, it's not true of money, because people, if they're not fed, do behave differently, as recent events in North Africa and other places are reminding people. So let's not make the assumption that things are going to carry on roughly the way they're going. We know in light of peak oil, there's going to be some big changes. So whilst you listen to Bernie Sanders, ask yourself, does he actually believe what he is asking for is ever going to happen? Who is going to break up these big banks, considering that they've already bought all the politicians around? Is he only suggesting this because that's the only thing he can think of? Now let's ask ourselves, as we listen to Bernie Sanders, how much of what we think, how much of our ideas, has been directed by the corporate agenda? how many beautiful possibilities have we cut off because we've decided that they're not feasible. We can't imagine them. So I hope this talk works as a kind of antidote to gradualism, to the idea that the money system we have is basically okay, we just need to erase the tax havens in the Cayman Islands, or start to introduce progressive tax legislation, or any kind of small set of changes that keep us within the framework of humans must compete with one another, and an artificial value set called money has to be elevated in importance above the natural world. And Bernie Sanders talks a lot about protecting the middle class, and he seems to me to want to roll the clock back half a century. Now, even if that were possible in terms of legislation and political thinking, it's certainly not possible in terms of environment. I find myself more convinced by the hypothesis put forward in Ascent of Humanity that this is a necessary phase to go through. I can testify to what he says, that garments workers in Bangladesh are extremely poor and are concerned about whether they'll get enough food to eat. I wish it was as simple as introducing minimum wage legislation, as he appears to believe. That's another topic in itself, but it shows me that he's suffering a kind of a wishful thinking. It would be nice if we could say this should be done, and it would be done. The reality, I think increasingly people are coming to see, that if that ever worked in the past, it's certainly not going to work in the future, and people of the world must do the things that they would like to be done. There must be the change, and not wait for other people to enact it.
The best of Bernie Sanders. High points from his Senate filibuster. We must break up the largest banks.
While we bailed out Wall Street because they were quote-unquote too big to fail, three out of the four largest financial institutions, all of whom were bailed out very significantly, are now larger today than they were before the bailout. Incredibly, Wells Fargo has grown 43% bigger, J.P. Morgan Chase has grown 51% bigger, and Bank of America is now 138% larger than before the financial crisis began.
This appeal was part of Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders' 8.5-hour filibuster speech in protest of the bill that, among other gifts, extended tax breaks to the richest Americans. And Sanders is not at all the only one who demands the breakup of the banks. Among the many conservatives, whose quotes you will hear in a moment, is Alan Greenspan, who also admits that he made a mistake by promoting deregulation when he headed the Federal Reserve. Senator Sanders began speaking on the morning of Friday, December 10, 2010, and held the floor until 7 p.m. His filibuster was carried on C-SPAN and crashed the Senate service. Here is Sanders laying out the urgent need to break up the banks.
The immediate cause of this crisis is, and you know, just gets me sick thinking about it, and that is what the crooks on Wall Street have done to the American people. These people fought for a period of years to deregulate the banking industry. These people said to us, well, you know, if you just will do away with Glass-Steagall, if you will just allow financial institutions, commercial banks, investor banks, insurance companies, if you allow them to merge, do away with these walls, which Glass-Steagall since the Depression had established, my God, it will be just terrific. It'll be good for our economy, good for the American people, good for our international competitiveness. And I remember that, those debates, Mr. President, because I was at that point in the House of Representatives. I was on the committee that dealt with that. And I remember all of the times that Alan Greenspan came before the committee and said, you know, and Robert Rubin, you're Republicans, you're Democrats, coming before the committee and saying, oh, it's what you got to do. You got to deregulate. Got to let these guys merge. Bigger is better. And against my votes, I did not think deregulation was a good idea. I thought it would lead to disaster in some place in this world. There is a quote of mine which kind of pretty much predicts what was going to happen. But needless to say, I was one vote, and majority of the members in the House and Senate voted to deregulate. And the rest is, unfortunately, history. And what we saw is that people on Wall Street, I think, you know, I may be wrong on this, but I think operating from a business model based on fraud, based on dishonesty, understanding that the likelihood of them ever getting caught was small, that if things got really bad, they would be bailed out by the taxpayers, understanding that they are too powerful to be ever be put in jail, to be indicted, understanding that in this country, when you're a CEO on Wall Street, you have so much wealth and so much power and have so many lawyers and so many friends in Congress that you could do pretty much anything you want and not much is going to happen to you. And they did it. They did it. Their greed and their recklessness and their illegal behavior destroyed this economy. And what they did to the American people is so horrible, so horrible. So here you had a middle class which is already being battered, as we discussed, as a result of trade agreements, loss of manufacturing jobs, health care costs going up, can't afford to send your kid to college. That's going on for years. And then these guys start pushing worthless and complicated financial instruments. The whole thing explodes. The whole thing explodes. And they come crying to the taxpayers of America to bail them out. And I will never forget, never forget, Hank Paulson coming before the Democratic caucus, saying that within a few days he needed $700 billion or the entire world financial system would collapse. And my suggestion to him at that meeting is, if you need the money, why don't you go to your friends and get the money? Why don't you go to all your banker friends and your millionaire friends and your billionaire friends and get some of that money, and don't go to the middle class of this country that has already been harmed? And in fact, we brought an amendment here to the floor of the Senate, and one of the first amendments that I brought as a senator, which would suggested that the top 2% should pay for the bailout, not the American people. It got defeated in a voice vote. So what goes on in Wall Street is that we have seen a tremendous concentration of ownership there, another issue that we do not talk enough about. I know Senator Brown and Senator Kaufman and I worked on a proposal to try to break up these large financial institutions. I think we got 30-some-odd votes on that. Couldn't do it. So what the American people should know now is that while we bailed out Wall Street because they were, quote-unquote, too big to fail, 3 out of the 4 largest financial institutions, all of whom were bailed out very significantly, are now larger today than they were before the bailout. Incredibly, since the start of the financial crisis, Wells Fargo has grown 43% bigger, J.P. Morgan Chase has grown 51% bigger, and Bank of America is now 138% larger than before the financial crisis began. Can you imagine that? We bailed these guys out because they were too big to fail, and now 3 out of the 4 largest ones are much larger than they were. How did that happen? Well, in 2008, Bank of America, the largest commercial bank in this country, which received a $45 billion taxpayer bailout, purchased Countrywide, the largest mortgage lender in this country, and Merrill Lynch, the largest stock brokerage firm in the country. That's how Bank of America expanded. In 2008, J.P. Morgan Chase, which received a $25 billion bailout from the Bush Treasury Department and a $29 billion bridge loan from the Federal Reserve, acquired Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual, the largest savings and loan in the country. That's how J.P. Morgan Chase, a huge bank, became even bigger. In 2008, the Treasury Department provided an $18 billion tax break to Wells Fargo to purchase Wachovia, allowing that bank to control 11% of all bank deposits in this country. Hear this, Mr. President, because this is just quite unbelievable. When we try to understand what's going on in the economy today, the rich getting richer, poor getting poorer, middle class collapsing, Today, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, the four largest financial institutions in this country, hold about $7.4 trillion in assets, and that is equal to over half of the nation's estimated total output last year. Four financial institutions have assets worth more than 52% of our total output last year. And instead of breaking these folks up, these large institutions up, we let them get bigger. In fact, Mr. President, according to Simon Johnson, the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, quote, as a result of the crisis and various government rescue efforts, the largest six banks in our economy now have total assets in excess, he claims, of 63% of GDP. This is a significant increase from even 2006, when the same bank's assets were around 55% of GDP. You understand what this is about? Four financial institutions owning over half of the assets of America. You talk about economic power. You talk about political power. That is what we were talking about. Simon Johnson continues, he said, this is a complete transformation compared with the situation in the United States just 15 years ago, when the largest six banks had combined assets of only about 17% of GDP. So today, 15 years ago, 17%, six banks, today four banks, he claims 63% of GDP. In other words, Mr. President, over the last 15 years, the largest banks in this country have more than tripled in size. Now, Mr. President, not only are too big to fail financial institutions bad for taxpayers, the enormous concentration of ownership in the financial sector has led to higher bank fees, usurious interest rates on credit cards, and fewer choices for consumers. What do you think happens when you have a few institutions, a handful of institutions, controlling mortgage lending or the ability of people, where people get their credit cards? Today, Mr. President, these huge financial institutions have become so big that, according to the Washington Post, the four largest banks in America now issue one out of every two mortgages, two out of three credit cards, and hold four out of every $10 in bank deposits in the entire country. Mr. President, if any of these financial institutions were to get into major trouble again, taxpayers would be on the hook for another substantial bailout, and we cannot allow that to happen. So the whole reason for the bailout is that if any of these financial institutions collapsed, it would take down a significant part of the economy and millions of jobs. We had to prop them up. We had to bail them out. And it turns out that since we bailed them out, these handful of financial institutions are enjoying very strong profits, and they are paying their CEOs even more in compensation than they did before the breakdown. In my view, Mr. President, if we are serious about understanding why the middle class is collapsing, if we are serious about really getting this economy moving again, long term, we have got to have the courage to do exactly what Teddy Roosevelt did back in the trust-busting days and break these banks up. The point that Roosevelt was making is that it is bad for the economy when a handful of entities control industry after industry. They have a stranglehold on the economy. You got to break them up. The legislation that I introduced last year, S-2746, the Too Big to Fail, Too Big to Exist Act, would break up these large financial institutions. That legislation would require the Secretary of Treasury to identify every single financial institution and insurance company in this country that is too big to fail within 90 days. And after 1 year, the Secretary of the Treasury would be required to break up these institutions so that their failure would not lead to the collapse of the U.S. or global economy. We passed a financial reform bill, which I supported and got a major provision in there asking for disclosure of the Fed and an investigation of conflicts of interest at the Fed and an audit of the Fed during the financial crisis. But overall, I by no means think that that legislation went anywhere near far enough. I think it was a modest piece of legislation, and I think that's an issue we've got to revisit. In my view, Mr. President, and I worry very much about the future because I have the feeling in my stomach that that day is going to come around again when these huge financial institutions are tottering, when they're going to go running to Washington and they're going to say, hey, you got to bail us out. In my view, if an institution is too big to fail, it is too big to exist. Let us break them up so that we do not have to go through another bailout of Wall Street. Furthermore, I believe that when you have that kind of concentration of ownership, when you have four large financial institutions holding half the mortgages in this country, controlling two-thirds of the credit cards, and amassing 40% of all deposits, this is not good for a competitive economy. We're supposed to be living in free market capitalism, real competition. This is not free market competition. This is a huge concentration of ownership where a few people have enormous power over the economy and, with their wealth, the political life of this country. No single financial institution should be so large that its failure would cause catastrophic risk to millions of American jobs or to our nation's economic well-being. No single financial institution should have holdings so extensive that its failure could send the world's economy into crisis. We were there 2 years ago, and in many ways, despite the passage of the financial reform bill, we are even more there now. The big, huge financial institutions that we bailed out are bigger, more huge today. And interestingly enough, on that issue, Mr. President, it is not just progressives like myself who hold that view. There are some pretty conservative folks who are honest conservatives. You have at least three Federal Reserve Bank presidents that support breaking up too big to fail banks. James Bullard, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, president and chief executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Kansas City Fed President Thomas M. Honig, and Dallas Fed President Richard W. Fisher. These guys don't have my political views. I am a proud progressive. My guess is they're conservatives. But anybody with an ounce of brains in your head understands that four large financial institutions that have assets that are more than half of the GDP of the United States of America places us, A, in a very dangerous position in terms of too big to fail, and B, it is just bad for a competitive economy. Is there any wonder why people are paying 25 or 30% interest rates on their credit cards? That's because these guys issue two-thirds of the credit cards in America. Is there any reason why they were issuing fraudulent mortgage packages to people? Because there is not the kind of competition that should be there. But this is not just Bernie Sanders' point of view. Here is what Kansas City Fed President Honig said, and I quote, "I think they should be broken up. I think there's no reason why, as we've done in other instances, of finding the right mechanism to break them into their components. And in doing so, I think you'll make the financial system itself more stable. And I think you will have long-run benefits over our current system, which mixes it and therefore leads to bailouts when crises occur." End of quote. This is Thomas Honig, the head of the Kansas City Fed. He's absolutely right. But, and I'm going to get to the reason why in a little while, we've not been able to do this. We've not been able to do this because Wall Street sends their lobbyists down here in droves, and Wall Street provides zillions of dollars in campaign contributions, and Wall Street fights like the Dickens to make sure that any strong provisions that some of us might bring up is defeated. Here is what the president of the Dallas Fed, Mr. Fischel, said, quote, based on my experience at the Fed, the marginal cost of too big to fail financial institutions easily dwarf their purported social and macroeconomic benefits. The risk posed by coddling too big to fail banks is simply too great. And Mr. Fischer continues, I think the disagreeable but sound thing to do regarding institutions that are too big to fail is to dismantle them over time into institutions that can be prudently managed and regulated across borders. And this should be done before the next financial crisis, because we now know it surely cannot be done in the middle of a crisis, end of quote. And that's Dallas Fed President Mr. Fischer. Mr. President, they are already in the process of breaking up big banks in England. According to the Washington Post, the British government announced a while back that it will break up parts of major financial institutions bailed out by taxpayers. The British government, spurred on by European regulators, is forcing the Royal Bank of Scotland, Lloyds Banking Group, and Northern Rock to sell off parts of their operations. The Europeans are calling for more and smaller banks to increase competition and eliminate the threat posed by banks so large that they must be rescued by taxpayers, no matter how they conducted their business, in order to avoid damaging the global financial system. Mr. President, very interesting development occurred on October 15th of last year. And as I mentioned earlier, Alan Greenspan, who was the chairman of the Fed before Mr. Bernanke, and I had our run-ins. Mr. Greenspan, along with Mr. Rubin and others, were the chief proponents, Larry Summers in there, were the chief proponents of deregulation of financial institutions. And Mr. Greenspan and I had more than a few arguments. But on October 15th of last year, Alan Greenspan, who admitted that his views on deregulation were wrong, and I give the man courage for at least admitting that he was wrong, did a heck of a lot of damage, but at least he had the courage to admit that he was wrong. He was quoted in Bloomberg News as saying, and I quote, if they are too big to fail, they are too big. In 1911, we broke up Standard Oil. So what happened? The individual parts became more valuable than the whole. Maybe that's what we need to do. End of quote. Alan Greenspan, the architect of deregulation, citing the fact that in 1911 we broke up Standard Oil. So here you have Greenspan, who helped cause this crisis, at least having the courage to understand that now is the time to begin breaking up these big financial institutions. They have enormous power over our economy. They have enormous power over our political life. Their lobbyists are all over this place. You can't walk down the hall without bumping into some of their lobbyists. So we've got to start breaking them up, and the American people have got to be prepared for a major fight to take on these huge financial institutions. Mr. President, former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, who has advised the Obama administration, supports breaking up big banks so that they no longer pose systemic risk to the entire economy. According to a recent article in the New York Times, Volcker said, and I quote, people say I'm old-fashioned and banks can no longer be separated from non-bank activity. That argument brought us to where we are today, end of quote, Paul Volcker. I couldn't agree more. That's what I'm talking about. You've got to start breaking up four financial institutions which led us into the economic disaster we're in right now, that remain much too big to fail, that we're going to have to bail out again and again and again, and that today have a stranglehold on our economy. The New York Times said that under Volcker's plan, quote, J.P. Morgan Chase would have to give up the trading operations acquired from Bear Stearns. Bank of America and Merrill Lynch would go back to being separate companies. Goldman Sachs could no longer be a bank holding company. End of quote. That's exactly what needs to be happening. The reality is, and I come from a small state, we have community banks. Here's the irony, Mr. President. The banks in Vermont, in the midst of all of this financial disaster, they did just fine. They are small, locally owned banks. They know the people they lend money to. The CEOs are not making hundreds of millions of dollars in profit. They know their community. They know what loans made sense. Now, I may be old-fashioned like Mr. Volcker, but I think that's what banking is about, to lend out money to people in the productive economy, to business community that can use the money to expand, create jobs, to homeowners that need that money to buy a home, not to be living in your own world, engaged in a huge gambling casino, producing and selling worthless products that nobody understands. In recent years, what we have seen, incredibly, 40% of all profits in America went to the financial institutions. Small number of people working there, relatively small. 40% of the profits, because it is a huge gambling casino. We need financial institutions to go back to the way banking used to be. And the job of banks is to provide affordable loans to the productive economy so that we can produce real products, real goods, and we can create real jobs when we do that. Robert Reich, President Clinton's former labor secretary, has said, quote, "No important public interest is served by allowing giant banks to grow too big to fail. Wall Street banks should be split up and soon." Got a lot of people, some conservatives, some progressives, are saying the same thing. If we're going to rebuild the middle class, the way to do that is, among other things, to change our disastrous trade policies, to make it clear to corporate America that they cannot continue to sell out the workers of this country by moving to China, other low-wage countries. And we also have got to have a much more competitive economy, one in which four large financial institutions do not own assets of more than half of the GDP of this country. And on that point, I find it very interesting that it's not just progressives like myself or Robert Reich, but you have some conservative bankers, people who are heading Fed banks around this country, who are saying pretty much the same thing.
Bernie Sanders was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. Before his 1990 election to Congress, Sanders lectured at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Thanks to C-SPAN for the audio from their 8.5-hour video. Links to the video, to Bernie Sanders' Senate webpage, and to the recipients of Federal Reserve largesse are on TUC Radio's website. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs.
Mr. President, when we talk about why the middle class is declining, that is a tough issue, and I'm not here to suggest that I know all of the answers. I surely don't. But let me touch on a few areas that I think will explain why poverty is going up and the middle class is going down. And one of them deals with our trade policies. A number of years ago, I was in the House of Representatives, and I can remember the lobbyists and the big money interests coming around and saying, well, if you guys only pass NAFTA, this would create a whole lot of jobs in the United States because we would be able to ship products made in America to Mexico. And in fact, as I recall, and it seems almost humorous now, what they said is that if we passed NAFTA, it would solve the problem of illegal immigration because the economy of Mexico would be so strong that people would stay in their own country and not try to sneak across the border. And that is, as we look back on it, somewhat humorous that that issue was even discussed. But one of the reasons, Mr. President, that unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, we have not dealt with is our disastrous trade policy. Trade policies which have encouraged large corporations in this country to send jobs abroad because they can find workers in other countries, in low-wage countries, who are prepared to work for pennies an hour. And, you know, I think not only haven't we addressed this issue from an economic perspective the way we should, and I have to tell you, Mr. President, I know that during campaigns, a lot of members of Congress put their 30-second ads on the air saying how concerned they are about outsourcing and our trade policy. But somehow the day after the election, I don't hear that discussion resumed on the floor of the House of the Senate. And I want to say this is true not just of Republicans, but of Democrats as well. A lot of Democrats campaign on the need for trade reform, but it doesn't happen. In fact, I've been here in the Senate now for almost 4 years, and I have not heard one serious, underlying serious discussion to explain how in recent years we have lost millions and millions of manufacturing jobs when those jobs were the backbone of the working class of this country, providing not only decent wages, but decent benefits, decent health care, decent pensions. Mr. President, there was once a time in this country when a manufacturing job was a ticket to the middle class. And I got to say something, because I remember not so many years ago, there were national leaders saying, well, to the young people, you don't have to worry about that factory work anymore. You don't have to be involved in production because, you know what, all of the jobs in the future is going to be nice and clean in offices and on computers. And I think we demeaned and insulted the people who built the products that we consume. There is nothing wrong with a factory job if workers there earn a decent wage and have a decent benefit. Those are the jobs that built America. And where are we today in terms of our manufacturing capabilities? A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I went shopping. It was just a plain old department store. Literally, very hard to find a product not manufactured in China. Very hard to find a product, a gift that we could buy that was manufactured in the United States of America. And I think people understand instinctually that this country will not be a major economic player in years to come if we allow our manufacturing base to continue to decline. Again, just under Bush, we went from 17 million manufacturing jobs down to 12 million jobs in 8 years of Bush. How do we survive as a strong industrial power if our manufacturing jobs disappear? Today, Mr. President, there are fewer manufacturing jobs in this country than there were in April of 1941, about 8 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Fewer manufacturing jobs today than in April of 1941. And those manufacturing jobs that are left, in many cases, pay lower wages with fewer benefits than they did a generation ago. In other words, we are moving not only in a decline in our manufacturing jobs, but in the wages that our workers earn and the benefits that they receive. And I raise all of these issues to put this agreement between the President and the Republican leadership in a broader context. Today, and this is just an incredible fact, and it is just absolutely frightening to the future of the middle class in this country. Today, entry-level automobile workers at General Motors and Chrysler now earn half as much as their peers made just 1 year ago. Instead of making $28 an hour, a middle-class wage, they are now making $14 an hour. And this is in the automobile industry, which has always been the gold standard for manufacturing jobs in America. And if workers with a union in the automobile industry are making $14 an hour, what do you think workers in New Mexico are going to be making without a strong union? So what you are seeing is a dissolution of the middle class. Wages are going down. And in this remarkable example, a 50% reduction. The older workers making good wages, new workers half the wages. Is this the future of America? Is this what our kids have to look forward to? That they're going to be earning half the wages that their fathers made, that their mothers made? Is that the future? And in the midst of all of that, we run up a huge national debt, send our jobs to China, and we give tax breaks to billionaires. Is that the future these kids have to look forward to? I certainly hope not. But let me tell you something. We're going to have to be tough, and we're going to have to take on some very powerful special interests to turn this whole thing around. Mr. President, you know, we often talk, and today I've been devoting a lot of time to our national debt, $13.7 trillion, and to our deficit, which is $1.4 trillion, but we cannot ignore our trade deficit. In 2008, our trade deficit was nearly $700 billion. Last year, our trade deficit with China alone was almost $227 billion. In other words, we are purchasing a whole lot more product than we are selling. And sometimes I get a kick out of hearing the defenders of our trade policy talk about all of the product that we are exporting. Well, yeah, we are exporting a lot, but we are importing a heck of a lot more. So, Mr. President, I think what you got is a major economic issue here, and that economic issue is that we are losing millions of good-paying jobs because of our disastrous trade policies, and furthermore, the jobs that we have. On those jobs, we're seeing a decline in wages and in benefits. And I think the bottom line of this is not just, if you like, an economic issue, it's a moral issue as well. And that is when companies like General Electric and all the rest, I don't mean to be picking hard on General Electric, but I have a quote here, which I want to make. This was a few years back. I think it's important because it applies not just to General Electric, but I want people to hear this. GE is, of course, one of our major corporations, and in fact, as recent disclosure pointed out, the taxpayers of this country through the Fed provided $16 billion in bailout to General Electric during the recent crisis. This is what the head of CEO of General Electric, Jeffrey Immelt, said in 2002, December 6th. Quote, Jeff Immelt, head of CEO, "When I am talking to GE managers, I talk China, 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 five Chinas. You need to be there. You need to change the way people talk about it and how they get there. I am a nut on China. Outsourcing from China is going to grow to $5 billion. We are building a tech center in China. Every discussion today has to center on China. The cost basis is extremely attractive. You can take an 18-cubic-foot refrigerator, make it in China, land it in the United States, and land it for less than we can make an 18-cubic-foot refrigerator today ourselves." End of quote. Jeffrey Immelt, chairman, CEO of General Electric, quoted in an investor meeting on December 6, 2002. When GE recently had, a couple of years ago, some really difficult economic times, they needed $16 billion to bail them out. I didn't hear Mr. Immelt going to China, 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 China. I didn't hear that. I heard Mr. Immelt going to the taxpayers of the United States for his welfare check. So I say to Mr. Immelt, and I say to all of these CEOs who have been so quick to run to China, that maybe it's time to start reinvesting in the United States of America. But it's not just Mr. Immelt. And I don't mean to just pick on him, it's all of them. They all see the future in China, in Vietnam, in countries where people work for pennies an hour. Now, Mr. Immelt came to his position in the footsteps of the former CEO of GE, Jack Welch. And what Jack Welch was famously quoted as saying, he said, "Ideally, we'd have every plant we own on a barge." End of quote. Remember that quote? What did he mean by that? What he meant by that, if you're on a barge, you can move your plant to any part of the world where the labor is cheapest. So if it gets too expensive in China and you got to pay people 75 cents an hour, you go to Vietnam. If it gets too expensive in Vietnam, maybe you can go to North Korea and have people work under martial law. I don't know. But what he was saying is his goal was to make sure that GE would create jobs in those countries in the world where workers were paid the lowest possible wages. And former GE Executive Vice President Frank Doyle said, and I quote, "We did a lot of violence to the expectations of the American workforce. We downsized, we delayered, and we outsourced." He was honest enough to admit what he did. But again, I don't mean to just pick on Jeff Immelt or General Electric. It is a history of corporations all over America. Let me just mention our CEO of Cisco, John Chambers. And this is what he says. And, you know, we tell the young people the future is in information technology. We want you guys to be smart, learn how to use the computers. You're not going to work in factories. This is what the CEO of Cisco, certainly one of the large IT companies in the United States, said. He said, quote, "China will become the IT center of the world. And we can have a healthy discussion about whether that's in 2020 or 2040. What we are trying to do is outline an entire strategy of becoming a Chinese company." End of quote. John Chambers, CEO of Cisco. This was in 2004. Furthermore, he says, "We believe in giving something back and truly becoming a Chinese company." Meanwhile, when Cisco needs tax breaks, they get it from the taxpayers of the United States of America. Boy, are they taking us for dummies. Now, in the last campaign, one of the folks who ended up getting a lot more publicity, I think, than he usually does, is the president and the CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a gentleman named Tom Donahue. And again, my point tonight is not to just to pick on individuals, because every quote that I'm giving you now can be multiplied 50, 100 times over. This is what corporate America believes. They believe that it is totally appropriate to throw American workers out on the street, move to low-wage countries, China and other countries, pay people a few cents an hour, bring their products back into the United States. Thomas Donahue is the president and CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he got a lot of publicity recently, especially during the last election, because the Chamber of Commerce became the funnel for a lot of money that went into campaigns around this country. They raised tens and tens of millions of dollars. A lot of that money, I believe, was undisclosed. So all the rich folks and the billionaires gave money to the Chamber of Commerce, and they were able to elect candidates that were sympathetic to their point of view. So let's find out what their point of view is. This is a quote, again, going back to 2004. Thomas Donahue, quote, "One job sent overseas, if it happens to be my job, is one too many. But the benefits of offshoring jobs outweighs the cost." End of quote. Tom Donahue, president and CEO of the largest business organization in America. They are in favor of offshoring American jobs. They think it is a good idea because they understand that if corporations throw American workers out on the street and go to China and pay people their pennies an hour, they are going to make more profits. That's what they say. Give them credit. They're upfront about it. We don't care about the United States of America. We don't care about young people. We don't care about the future of this country. Jeff Immelt told us the future of the world is in China. And here is a quote that appeared in one of the papers, an AP story. U.S. Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Thomas Donahue. This is the head of the largest business organization in America. That's where all these businesses come together to develop policy, to lobby us, to provide campaign contributions. U.S. Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Thomas Donahue urged American companies to send jobs overseas. Now, that's really patriotic. That's standing up for the United States of America. Donahue said Wednesday that exporting high-paid tech jobs to low-cost countries such as India, China, and Russia saves companies money. It is no surprise that Donahue, who tripled the Chamber of Commerce's lobbying team since 1997 and aggressively promotes pro-business policies, endorses offshoring. The 3 million member organizations of the Chamber of Commerce, the world's largest business consortium, champions tax cuts, free trade, workers' compensation reform, and more liberal trade policies with China. End of quote. What more do you need when you want to understand why we have lost millions of good-paying manufacturing jobs, why wages are going down? What more do you need when the president of the Chamber of Commerce tells you that he thinks it is good public policy to send jobs to China? Now, in a moment, what I'm going to be talking about is how these ideas from the big money people become implemented into policy, which has to do a lot with lobbying and campaign contributions. Before I go there, I want to talk about how the business leaders of this country feel about the workers of this country and the young people of this country. This, again, is a quote that I apologize. It is a few years old, but 2004, perhaps? 2004. Quote, January 19th. This is from Alan Lacy, who was then the CEO of Sears Roebuck and Company. Here's what he said. Quote, there are four or five times as many smart, driven people in China than there are in the United States. And there's another four or five, three or four times as many people in India that are smarter or as smart or have more drive. And if technology is now going to basically reduce location as a barrier to competition, i.e., you have a worldwide web and you could do your work in China or India, then essentially you've got something like whatever that was, seven or nine times more smart, committed people that are now competing in this marketplace against certain activities. So we're going to see, I think, this huge incentive to shift some of these more commodity-like knowledge workers' jobs offshore. So here you have our blue-collar jobs decimated, and we told the kids not to worry. You didn't want to work in a factory anyhow. We've got these good information technology, computer-based jobs for you. But then you have the heads of large corporations saying, hey, why do I want to get American young people to do this? I can have Indian young people do it who will work for a fraction of the wages. And I think we all see this. I mean, it's nothing new. You try to get a plane reservation right now and you're talking to somebody in India. And please do not hear me to be anti-India or anti-Chinese. That is the furthest thing that I would want anyone to think. We want to work with people all over the world. But you don't have to destroy the middle class of this country to help people around the world. You don't have to be a corporate CEO to sell out your own people who built your company to run abroad. So this senator is not anti-Chinese, far from it, anti-Indian, anti-Vietnamese, not at all. I guess I plead guilty to being pro-American. I don't know. Maybe that's suspect here. The former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina. And this obviously, Ms. Fiorina ran for senator. And this is what she said when she was the CEO of Hewlett-Packard in 2004. She said, quote, there is no job that is America's God-given right anymore, end of quote. I could go on and on and on, but I think you got the point. And the point is that when things get rough for corporate America, as they did recently for General Electric, they run to the taxpayers of this country in order to be bailed out. But their overall philosophy is that their goal in life is to make as much money as they can in any way they can, and therefore you run to those countries where wages are low. And what you're seeing now, and you're seeing it all of the time, and it's not just blue-collar, it is increasingly white-collar. You have radiologists who are able to read x-rays in India. You have people, you know, people behind the computer can do work in India as well as here. And these corporate folks have taken advantage of that and sold out young people of this country and the working class of this country. Mr. President, as you know, it is virtually impossible to find anything in a Walmart or other stores like that is made in America today. This is especially true for clothing. An increasing amount of our clothing comes from Bangladesh. Today, there are 4,000 garment factories in Bangladesh making clothes for Walmart, Gap, JCPenney, Levi Strauss, Tommy Hilfiger, and many, many others. Garment workers in Bangladesh, some 3.5 million of them, and that number is growing, are among the lowest paid workers in the world, and they have difficulty buying enough food and shelter for their own needs. As I mentioned earlier today, the good news is the minimum wage in Bangladesh was doubled. It went from 11.5 cents an hour to 23 cents an hour. So when you buy a shirt made in Bangladesh, you have young women there coming in from the countryside who are paid now, have received a doubling of their minimum wage to 23 cents an hour. Is that something that our people should be asked to compete against? Should we say to the American worker, hey, we can get you jobs. We're prepared to invest in the United States. Yeah, we're an American company. You helped make us great. Thank you for the work you've done over the years. Thank you for purchasing our products. Thank you for making us strong. And if you are prepared to work for $1 an hour, $2 an hour, $3 an hour, you know, we'll come back. And by the way, Mr. President, I think you know this. In the last campaign, what did we hear? What are we beginning to hear rumbles about? Abolishing the minimum wage. Abolishing the minimum wage. Minimum wage now is $7.25 an hour. That's what we say should be the minimum that any American worker gets. There are people out there who say, look, if I can hire somebody in China for $2 or $3 an hour and you want a job in America and I have to pay you $7.25 an hour, why would I want to do that? If we abolish the minimum wage, hey, I may hire you. Now, what a wonderful prospect for our young people to think about working for $4 or $5 an hour. So, Mr. President, I think if we want to understand why the middle class in this country is collapsing, why unemployment is high, why our manufacturing base has been decimated, why it is hard to purchase a product made in the United States, it has a lot to do with our trade policies, which were pushed by people like Mr. Donahue of the Chamber of Commerce and many, many others.
Take it by stealing. Lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good, and I'm friendly to strangers.
That concludes this week's show, which, as always, is available, as are all previous episodes, as MP3 downloads from unwelcomeguest.net/archive. I hope you've learnt not only a little from Bernie Sanders, but picked up some of his defiant spirit and had your faith strengthened that even in the most corrupt institutions, there are courageous people speaking out, determined to do what they think is right. In the future, I hope to be doing a few episodes on money, so I'd be especially interested if you could point me to any resources on that topic which you think are relevant for the show. Now, you could do that either via emailing me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguest.net, or through the mailing list, which you can join through altruists.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Keep giving all you can. The more we give one another, the more we are following our heart, stepping out of the financial framework of control, which would divide us and conquer us all. Thank you for listening.